The following program is a production of Sight Into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the 11th reading of Camino Island by John Gresham. I'm Rosina Chevalier. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Mercer spends the weekend at Bruce's house, and they have great sex. On Sunday evening, he takes her to the bookstore, and they have drinks. On a whim, he shows her the manuscript of the Fitzgerald story that he's in possession of. She freaks out and leaves after admonishing him for dealing in stolen goods. She tells Elaine, and the feds are brought in. She testifies before a federal magistrate in Jacksonville. Now we continue with Camino Island. Chapter 8, The Delivery. Denny had been on the island for 10 days and was losing patience. He and Rooker had tracked Cable and knew his movements. A monotonously simple task. They had tracked Mercer, too, and knew her habits. Another easy chore. Intimidation had worked with Oscar Stein in Boston, and perhaps it was their only plausible tool. Direct confrontation with the threat of violence. As with Stein, Cable could not exactly run to the cops. If he had the manuscripts, he could be coerced into cutting a deal. If he didn't, then he almost certainly knew where they were. Cable usually left work around 6 in the evening and went home. At 5:50 Monday afternoon, Denny entered the store and pretended to browse around. As luck would have it, Cable's luck, that is, he was busy in the basement, and his clerks knew not to divulge this. Denny, though, had just run out of luck. After months of moving seamlessly through airports and customs and security checkpoints and using fake IDs and passports and disguises and paying cash when possible for rooms and rentals, he was thinking of himself as quite clever, if not invincible. But even the smartest cons get busted when they drop their guard. For years, the FBI had been perfecting its facial recognition technology, software it referred to as FacePrint. It used an algorithm to calculate the distance between a subject's eyes, nose, and ears, and in milliseconds applied it to a bank of photos relevant to a particular investigation. In the Gatsby file, as the stolen manuscripts case had been nicknamed by the FBI, the bank was comparatively small. It included a dozen photos of the three thieves at the front desk of the Firestone Library, though Jerry Steengarten and Mark Driscoll were in custody. It also included several hundred photos of men known or suspected to be active in the world of stolen art, artifacts, and books. When Denny entered the store, the camera hidden in the Lonesome Dove audio case captured his face, as it had routinely captured the face of every other customer since noon that day. The image was sent to the laptop in the rear of the van across the street, and more important, to the FBI's mammoth forensic lab at Quantico, Virginia. There was a match. An alarm alerted a technician. Within seconds of entering the store, Denny was identified as the third Gatsby thief. Two had been caught. Trey, the fourth, was still decomposing at the bottom of a pond in the Poconos, never to be found nor implicated. Ahmed, the fifth, was still hiding in Europe. After 15 minutes, Denny left the store, walked around the corner, and got into a 2011 Honda Accord. The second van followed it at a distance, lost it, then found it parked in the lot of the Seabreeze Motel on the beach, 100 yards from the Lighthouse Inn. A stakeout began. The Honda Accord had been rented from an agency in Jacksonville that advertised rent-a-wrecks and didn't mind dealing in cash. The name on the application was Wilbur Shiflett, and the manager admitted to the FBI that he thought the main driver's license looked bogus. Shiflett had paid $1,000 cash for a 2-week rental and waived the insurance. The FBI was stunned at this development, at its incredible good fortune. But why would one of the thieves hang around the bookstore some 8 months after the theft? Was he also watching Mercer? Did he have a connection to cable? There were many baffling questions to be dealt with later, but at the moment, it was a strong indication that Mercer was right. At least one of the manuscripts was in the basement. At sunset, Denny stepped out of room 18 and Rooker stepped out of the room next door. They walked 100 yards to the Surf, a popular outdoor bar and grill, where they dined on sandwiches and beer. While they were eating, 4 FBI agents walked into the office of the Seabreeze and handed the manager a search warrant. In room 18, they found a gym bag under the bed. It contained a 9mm pistol, $6,000 in cash, and fake driver's licenses from Tennessee and Wyoming. Nothing, though, revealed Wilbur's true identity. The agents found nothing of value in the room next door. When Denny and Rooker returned to the Seabreeze, they were arrested and driven in total silence and in separate cars to the FBI office in Jacksonville. They were processed and fingerprinted. Both sets of prints were pushed through the data bank, and by 10 p.m. the truth was known. Denny's military prints revealed his name, Dennis Allen Durbin, age 33, born in Sacramento. Rooker's criminal record nailed him. Byron Bayer, age 39, born in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Both refused to cooperate and were put away. Lamar Bradshaw decided to bury them for a few days and sit on the news of their arrests. Mercer was with Elaine, Rick, and Graham in the safe house, playing gin rummy and killing time. They had been told of the arrests, but did not know the details. Bradshaw called at 11, spoke with Elaine, and filled in most of the missing pieces. Things were obviously happening fast. There were a lot of unanswered questions. Tomorrow was the big day. As for Mercer, Bradshaw said, get her off the island. They watched the store even more closely throughout Tuesday and saw nothing out of the ordinary. No more thieves lurking around, no suspicious packages shipped. A UPS truck delivered 6 boxes of books at 10:50, but left with nothing. Cable was upstairs and down, helping customers, reading as always in his favorite spot. And, of course, he left for lunch at 12:15, returning an hour later. At 5, Lamar Bradshaw and Derry Vano entered the store and asked Cable if they could have a word. Quietly, Bradshaw said, FBI. They followed him to the first edition's room, where he closed the door. He asked for identification, and they whipped out their badges. Vano handed over a search warrant and said, we're here to search the basement. Still standing, Bruce asked, okay, and what might you be looking for? Stolen manuscripts from the collection of F. Scott Fitzgerald, property of the Princeton Library, Bradshaw said. Bruce laughed and, without missing a beat, said, Are you serious? Do we look serious? I guess you do. Mind if I read this? He waved the search warrant. Go right ahead. And as of now, we have 5 agents in the store, including us. Well, make yourself at home. There's coffee upstairs. We know. Bruce sat at his desk and read the search warrant. He took his time, flipped pages, and gave a good impression of being unconcerned. When he finished, he said, Okay, it's fairly straightforward. He stood and stretched and thought about what to do next. It's limited to the vault in the basement, right? That's correct, Bradshaw said. There's a lot of valuable stuff down there, and, well, you guys are famous for trashing a place when you go in with warrants. You watch too much television, Vano said. We know what we're doing, and if you cooperate, no one else in the store will even know we're here. I doubt that. Let's go. Clutching the search warrant, Bruce led them to the back of the store, where they were met by 3 more agents, all dressed casually. Bruce ignored them and unlocked the door to the basement. He flipped a light switch and said, Watch your step. In the basement, he turned on more lights and stopped at the door to the vault, where he punched in the code. He opened the vault, turned on its light, and when all 5 agents were crowded inside, he waved at the walls and said, Those are all rare first editions. Nothing of interest, I suppose. 1 agent removed a small video camera and began filming the interior of the vault. Open the safe, Bradshaw said, and Bruce complied. When he opened its doors, he pointed to the top shelves and said, These are all very rare. Do you want to see them? Maybe later, Bradshaw said. Let's start with those 4 drawers. He knew precisely what he wanted. Bruce pulled out the first one. It contained 2 cedar boxes, just as Mercer had reported. He lifted one, placed it on the table, and opened the top. This is the original manuscript of Darker Than Amber, published by John D. MacDonald in 1966. I bought this about 10 years ago, and I have the invoice to prove it. Bradshaw and Vano hovered over the manuscript. Mind if we touch it? Vano asked. Both were experienced and knew what they were doing. Be my guest. The manuscript was typed, and the pages were in good condition with almost no fading. They flipped through it and soon lost interest. And the other? Bradshaw asked. Bruce removed the 2nd cedar box, placed it beside the 1st, and lifted the top. This is another MacDonald manuscript, The Lonely Silver Rain, published in 1985. Got an invoice for this one, too. It, too, was neat and typewritten, with notes in the margins. To help matters, Bruce added, MacDonald lived on a boat with little electricity. He used an old manual Underwood typewriter and was meticulous about his work. His manuscripts are incredibly neat. They didn't care, but turned a few pages anyway. For a bit of fun, Bruce said, I'm not sure, but didn't Fitzgerald handwrite his original manuscripts? There was no reply. Bradshaw turned back to the safe and said, The 2nd drawer. Bruce pulled it out as the 2 inched closer, straining for a look. It was empty. Same for the 3rd and 4th. Bradshaw was stunned and shot a wild look at Vano, who was gawking at the empty drawers in utter disbelief. Reeling, Bradshaw said, Empty the contents of the safe. Bruce said, No problem, but it's obvious, at least to me, that someone has fed you guys some bad information. I don't trade in stolen stuff, and I wouldn't go near the Fitzgerald manuscripts. Empty the safe, Bradshaw said again, ignoring him. Bruce returned the two MacDonald manuscripts to the top drawer, then reached to the top shelf and removed a clamshell holding Catcher in the Rye. "You want to see it?" "Yes," Bradshaw replied. Bruce carefully opened the clamshell and removed the book. He held it up for them to see and video, then put it back. "And you want to see all of them?" "That's right." "It's a waste of time. These are published novels, not manuscripts." "We know that." "These clamshells are custom made for each book and much too small to hold a manuscript." That much was obvious, but time was not a factor, and a thorough search was required. "Next," Bradshaw said, nodding at the shelves in the safe. Methodically, Bruce removed the books one at a time, opened the clamshells, displayed the books, then set them aside. As he happily went about his business, Bradshaw and Vano shook their heads, glared at each other, rolled their eyes, and in general looked as baffled as a couple of hoodwinked agents could possibly look. When all 48 were stacked on the table, the safe was empty but for the two MacDonald manuscripts in the top drawer. Bradshaw stepped closer to the safe, as if looking for secret compartments, but it was obvious there was no room for one. He scratched his jaw and ran his fingers through his thinning hair. Vano asked, "What about these?" and waved at the bookshelves against the walls. Bruce said, "They're rare first editions, books published a long time ago. It's a collection I've spent 20 years putting together. Again, they're novels, not manuscripts. I suppose you want to see them too?" "Oh, why not?" Vano said. Bruce pulled out keys and unlocked the bookshelves. The agents spread out and began lifting the glass doors to the shelves, inspecting the row of books, finding nothing even remotely resembling a bulky manuscript. Bruce watched them carefully, eager to step in if a book were removed. But they were careful and very professional, and after an hour in the vault, the search was over and had yielded nothing. Every inch of it had been examined. As they filed out, Bruce pulled the door shut but didn't lock it. Bradshaw looked around the basement and took in the shelves stuffed with old books, magazines, galleys, and advanced reading copies. "Mind if we take a look?" he asked in one last desperate attempt to find something. Bruce said, "Well, according to the warrant, the search is limited to the vault. But what the hell? Have a look. You're not going to find anything." "So you consent?" "Sure, why not? Let's waste some more time." They fanned out through the junk room and peeked and poked for half an hour, as if trying to delay the inevitable. Admitting defeat was unthinkable, but they finally gave up. Bruce followed them up the stairs to the front door. Bradshaw offered a hand and said, "Sorry for the inconvenience." Bruce shook hands and asked, "So, is this it for me, or am I still a suspect?" Bradshaw pulled a business card from his pocket and handed it to Bruce. "I'll give you a call tomorrow and answer that question." "Great. Better still, I'll get my lawyers to call you." "Do that." When they were gone, Bruce turned and noticed two clerks behind the front counter, staring. "DEA," he said, "looking for a meth lab. Now get back to work." The oldest bar on the island was the Pirate's Saloon, three blocks east of the bookstore. After dark, Bruce met his lawyer, Mike Wood, there for a drink. They huddled in a corner, and over bourbon, Bruce described the search. Mike was too experienced to inquire as to whether Bruce knew anything about the stolen manuscripts. Bruce asked, "Is it possible to find out if I'm still their target?" "Maybe. I'll call the guy tomorrow, but I assume the answer is yes." I'd like to know if I'm going to be followed for the next 6 months. Look, Mike, I'm going to the south of France next week to hang out with Noel. If these guys are going to track me all over the place, I'd like to know it. Hell, I'll give them my flight numbers and call them when I get home. I have nothing to hide. I'll tell the guy, but for now, assume they're watching every move, listening to every phone, and reading every email and text message. Bruce feigned disbelief and frustration, but in reality, for the past 2 months, he'd been living with the assumption that someone, possibly the FBI or perhaps someone else, was watching and listening. The following day, Wednesday, Mike Wood called Lamar Bradshaw's cell phone 4 times and was sent straight to voicemail. He left messages. None of them returned. On Thursday, Bradshaw called back and confirmed that Mr. Cable was a person of interest, but no longer the target of their investigation. Mike informed Bradshaw that his client would soon be leaving the country and passed along his flight number and the hotel in Nice, where he would be staying for a few days with his wife. Bradshaw thanked him for the information and said the FBI had no interest in Cable's foreign travels. On Friday, Denny Durbin and Byron Bayer, also known as Joe Rooker, were flown to Philadelphia, then driven to Trenton, where they were again processed and placed in separate cells. Denny was then taken into an interrogation room, sat at a table, given a cup of coffee, and told to wait. Mark Driscoll and his lawyer, Gil Petricelli, were led by Special Agent McGregor to the hallway outside the interrogation room, and through a one-way window they took a look at Denny, sitting all alone and looking bored. "We nabbed your buddy," McGregor said to Mark, "caught him in Florida." "So?" Petricelli said. "So now we have all three of you, the three who were inside the Firestone Library. Seen enough?" Driscoll said, "Yes." They walked away and entered another interrogation room 2 doors down. When they were seated around a small table, McGregor said, "We don't know who else was involved, but there were others. Someone outside the library created the diversion while the three of you were inside. Someone else hacked the campus security system and electrical grid. That's 5. Could be more. Only you can tell us. We're closing in on the manuscripts and will soon have a fresh batch of indictments. We are willing to offer the mother of all deals, Mr. Driscoll. You sing and you walk. Tell us everything, and your indictment is forgotten. You enter witness protection, and we'll set you up in some nice place with new papers, a good job, whatever you want. If there's a trial, you'll have to come back and testify, but frankly, I doubt that'll happen." For Mark, 8 months in jail were enough. Denny was the dangerous one, and now that he was neutralized, so much of the pressure was off. The threat of retaliation was greatly diminished. Trey was not the violent type and lived on the run anyway. If Mark gave up Trey's real name, he might soon be caught. Ahmed was a wimpish computer nerd who was afraid of his shadow. The thought of him exacting revenge seemed quite remote. "Give me some time," Mark said. "We'll talk about it," Petricelli said. "Okay, today is Friday. You have the weekend to make a decision. I'll be back Monday morning. After that, all offers are off the table." On Monday, Mark took the deal. On Tuesday, July 19, Bruce Cable flew from Jacksonville to Atlanta, boarded an Air France jet for a nonstop flight to Paris, then killed 2 hours before connecting to Nice. He arrived there at 8 in the morning and took a cab to the Hotel La Perouse, a stylish boutique hotel at the edge of the sea, a place he and Noel had discovered during their first trip to France 10 years earlier. She was standing in the lobby, waiting and looking very French, in a short white dress and smart wide-brimmed straw hat. They kissed and embraced as if it had been years, and walked hand in hand to the terrace by the pool, where they sipped champagne and kissed again. When Bruce said he was hungry, they went to their room on the third floor and ordered room service. They ate on the terrace and soaked in the sun. The beach stretched for miles below them, and beyond it, the Côte d'Azur shimmered in the sun. Bruce had not taken a day off in months and was ready for serious relaxation. After a long nap, the jet lag was gone and they went to the pool. As always, he asked about Jean-Luc, and Noel said he was fine. He sent his regards. She asked about Mercer, and Bruce told all the stories. He doubted they would ever see her again. Late in the afternoon, they left the hotel and walked 5 minutes into Old Town, a triangle-shaped section dating back centuries and the city's main attraction. They drifted with the crowds, taking in the busy outdoor markets, window shopping at the boutiques along streets too narrow for automobiles, and having ice cream and coffee at one of the many outdoor cafes. They meandered through alleyways, got lost more than once, but never for long. The sea was always visible just around the next corner. They were often hand in hand, never far apart, and at times seemed to cling to each other. On Thursday, Bruce and Noel slept late, had breakfast on the terrace, and eventually showered and dressed and returned to the Old Town. They strolled through the flower markets and marveled at the spectacular varieties, many of them unknown even to Noel. They had an espresso at another cafe and watched the throngs around the Baroque Cathedral at Place Rossetti. As noon approached, they eventually drifted to the edge of the Old Town, to a street that was slightly wider with a few vehicles jostling about. They ducked into an antiques store, and Noel chatted with the owner. A handyman led them to the rear, to a small workshop packed with tables and armoires in various stages of repair. He pointed to a wooden crate and told Noel it had just arrived. She checked the shipping tag stapled to one corner and asked the handyman to open the crate. He found his drill and began removing 2-inch screws that secured the top, a dozen of them, and he worked slowly, methodically, as he evidently had for many years. Bruce watched him closely while Noel seemed more interested in another old table. When he finally finished, he and Bruce lifted the top of the crate and set it aside. Noel said something to the handyman, and he disappeared. Bruce removed thick packing foam from the crate, and suddenly he and Noel were staring at Mercer's writing desk. Below its surface were the facings of 3 drawers that had been removed to create a hidden space. With a claw hammer, Bruce gently pried open the surface. Inside were 5 identical cedar boxes, all custom-built to his specs by a cabinet maker on Camino Island, Gatsby and Friends. The meeting convened at 9 a.m., and gave every impression of becoming a marathon. The long table was covered with paperwork already scattered as if they had been working for hours. At the far end, a large screen had been set up, and next to it was a platter of donuts and 2 pots of coffee. Agent McGregor and 3 more FBI agents took one inside. Carlton, the assistant U.S. attorney, took the other, flanked by his entourage of unsmiling young men in dark suits. At the other end, in the hot seat, sat Mark Driscoll, with his ever-faithful lawyer, Petrocelli, at his left elbow. Mark was already savoring delicious thoughts of life on the outside, of freedom in a new world. He was ready to talk. McGregor went first and said, "Let's start with the team. There were three on the inside, right?" "That's right. Me, Jerry Steengarten, and Denny Durbin. And the others?" "Right. Well, on the ground outside the library was Tim Maldonado. Went by Trey. Not sure where he's from because he's lived most of his life on the run. His mother is a woman named Iris Green, and she lives on Baxter Road in Muncie, Indiana. You can go see her, but I doubt if she's seen her boy in years. Trey escaped from a federal pen in Ohio about 2 years ago." "Why do you know where his mother lives?" McGregor asked. "It was all part of the plan. We memorized a bunch of useless stuff to convince ourselves to remain silent in the event somebody got caught. The threat of retaliation, which sounded real smart back then." "And when did you last see Trey?" "November 12 of last year, the day Jerry and I left the cabin and drove to Rochester. We left him there with Denny. I have no idea where he might be." On the screen, a mugshot appeared and Trey was smiling at them. "That's him," Mark said. "And what was his role?" "Diversion. He caused the commotion with his smoke bombs and fireworks. He called 911 and said there was a guy with a gun shooting students. I made two or three calls myself from inside the library." "Okay, we'll get back to that. Who else was involved?" "There were only five of us, and the fifth was Ahmed Mansour, an American of Lebanese descent, who worked out of Buffalo. He was not on the scene that night. He's a hacker, forger, computer expert, long career with government intelligence before he got booted and turned to crime. He's about 50 years old, divorced, lives with a woman at 662 Washburn Street in Buffalo. To my knowledge, he has no criminal record." Even though Mark was being filmed and recorded, all four FBI agents and all five grim-faced young men from the U.S. Attorney's Office scribbled furiously as if their notes were important. McGregor said, "Okay, if there were only five, then who is this guy?" Byron Bayer's face appeared on the screen. "Never seen him before." Petrocelli said, "That's the guy who slapped me around in the parking lot a few weeks back, warned me to tell my client to keep his mouth shut." McGregor said, "We caught him with Denny in Florida, a career thug, name of Byron Bayer, but went by Rooker." "Don't know him," Mark said. "He was not part of our team. Must be someone Denny picked up to look for the manuscripts. We don't know much about him, and he's not talking," McGregor said. "He was not a player," Mark said. "We'll get back to the team. Tell us about the plan. How did it get started?" Mark smiled, relaxed, took a long sip of coffee, and began his narrative. "Deep in the left bank of Paris, in the heart of the 6th arrondissement, on Rue Saint-Sulpice, Monsieur Gaston Chapelle ran a tidy little bookshop that had changed little in 28 years. Such stores are scattered throughout the center of the city, each with a different specialty. Monsieur Chapelle's was rare French, Spanish, and American novels of the 19th and 20th centuries. Two doors down, a friend dealt only in ancient maps and atlases. Around the corner, another traded in old prints and letters written by historic figures, Generally, there was little foot traffic in and out of these stores. A lot of window shopping, but few customers. Their clients were serious collectors from around the world, not tourists looking for something to read. On Monday, July 25, Monsieur Chappelle locked his shop at 11 a.m. and stepped into a waiting taxi. 20 minutes later, it stopped in front of an office building on Avenue Montaigne in the 8th arrondissement, and he got out. As he entered the building, he gave a cautious look at the street behind him, though he expected to see nothing unusual. There was nothing illegal about his mission, at least not under French law. He spoke to the lovely receptionist and waited as she called upstairs. He shuffled about the lobby, admiring the art on the walls and taking in the breadth and reach of the law firm's ambition. Scully and Pershing announced the bold bronze lettering with offices in, and he counted them, 44 cities in every important country and a few lesser ones. He'd spent some time with its website and knew that Scully boasted of having 3,000 lawyers and being the largest firm in the world. Once his presence was approved, the receptionist cleared him to proceed to the third floor. He took the stairs and soon found the office of one Thomas Kendrick, a ranking partner chosen solely because of his undergraduate degree from Princeton. That was followed by two law degrees, first from Columbia and then from the Sorbonne. Mr. Kendrick was 48 years old, originally from Vermont, but now with dual citizenship. He was married to a French lady and had never left Paris after the Sorbonne. He specialized in complex litigation of an international nature and, at least on the phone, had seemed reluctant to grant an appointment to the lowly bookshop owner. Monsieur Chappelle, though, had been persistent. Speaking in French, they got through the rather stiff formalities, and soon enough Mr. Kendrick said, "Now, what can I do for you?" Monsieur replied, "You have close ties to Princeton University, having once served on its board of trustees. I assume you know its president, Dr. Carlyle." "Yes, I'm very involved with my school. May I ask why this is important?" "It is very important. I have a friend who has an acquaintance who knows the man in possession of the Fitzgerald manuscripts. This man would like to return them to Princeton, for a price, of course." Kendrick's professional $1,000-an-hour facade vanished, and his jaw dropped slightly. His eyes bulged, and he looked as though he'd been kicked in the gut. Chappelle continued, "I am just the intermediary, same as you. We need your assistance." The last thing Mr. Kendrick needed was another task, especially one that would pay him nothing and devour his valuable time. However, the appeal of getting involved in such a wonderfully unique transaction was almost overwhelming. If this guy could be believed, he, Kendrick, would play a vital role in bringing home a prize his beloved university treasured above all others. He cleared his throat and said, "The manuscripts are safe and still together, I take it?" "Indeed." Kendrick smiled as his thoughts raced away. "And the delivery would take place where?" "Here, Paris. The delivery will be carefully planned and all instructions must be strictly adhered to. Obviously, Mr. Kendrick, we're dealing with a criminal who is in possession of priceless assets, and he prefers not to get caught. He is very clever and calculating, and if there is the slightest misstep or confusion or hint of trouble, the manuscripts will disappear forever. Princeton will have only this one chance to retrieve the papers. Notifying the police would be a grave mistake. I'm not sure Princeton will get involved without the FBI. I don't know this, of course. Then there will be no deal, period. Princeton will never see them again. Kendrick stood and stuffed his fine shirt deeper into his tailored slacks. He walked to a window, glanced out at nothing, and said, "What's the price?" "A fortune." "Of course. I have to give them some idea." $4 million per manuscript, and not negotiable. For a pro who wrangled with lawsuits worth billions, the amount of the ransom did not faze Kendrick, nor would it scare Princeton. He doubted his university had that much mad money lying around, but there was a $25 billion endowment and thousands of wealthy alumni. Kendrick moved away from the window and said, "Obviously, I need to make some calls. When do we meet again?" Chappelle stood and said, "Tomorrow. And I caution you again, Mr. Kendrick, that any involvement by the police here or in the U.S. would be catastrophic." "I hear you. Thanks for stopping by, Mr. Chappelle." They shook hands and said goodbye. At 10 the following morning, a black Mercedes sedan stopped on Rue de Vaugirard in front of the Luxembourg Palace. From the back seat, Thomas Kendrick emerged and began walking along the sidewalk. He entered the famous gardens through a wrought iron gate and drifted with a throng of tourists to the octagonal lake, where hundreds, both Parisians and visitors alike, whiled away the morning, sitting and reading, taking in the sun. Children raced their toy boats across the water. Young lovers sprawled and groped on the lake's low concrete walls. Packs of joggers hustled about, talking and laughing. At the monument to Delacroix, Kendrick was joined without a greeting by Gaston Chappelle, briefcase in hand. They walked on, ambling along the wide pathways and moving away from the lake. "Am I being watched?" Kendrick asked. "There are people here, yes. The man with the manuscripts has accomplices. Am I being watched?" "No, I assure you." "Good. I assume your conversations went well?" "I leave for the U.S. in 2 hours. Tomorrow I will meet with the folks at Princeton. They understand the rules. As you might guess, Mr. Chappelle, they would like some type of verification." Without stopping, Chappelle pulled a folder from his briefcase. "This should suffice," he said. Kendrick took it as they walked. "May I ask what's inside?" Chappelle offered a wicked smile and said, "It's the first page of Chapter 3, The Great Gatsby. As far as I can tell, it's authentic." Kendrick stopped cold and mumbled, "Good God!" Dr. Jeffrey Brown practically jogged across the Princeton campus and bounded up the front steps of Nassau Hall, the administration building. As the director of the manuscripts division at the Firestone Library, he could barely remember his last visit to the president's office. And he knew for a fact that he had never been summoned for a meeting described as urgent. His job had never been that exciting. The secretary was waiting and escorted him to the grand office of President Carlisle, who was also standing and waiting. Dr. Brown was quickly introduced to the university's in-house counsel, Richard Farley, and to Thomas Kendrick. For Brown, at least, the tension in the room was palpable. Carlisle gathered the four around a small conference table and said to Brown, "Sorry for the short notice, but we've been given something that needs verification." Yesterday in Paris, Mr. Kendrick was handed a single sheet of paper that is said to be the first page of the third chapter of F. Scott Fitzgerald's original manuscript of The Great Gatsby. Take a look. He slid over a folder and opened it. Brown, gasping, looked at the page, gently touched the top right corner, and buried his face in his hands. 2 hours later, President Carlyle convened a second meeting at the same table. Dr. Brown had been excused, and in his chair sat Elaine Shelby. Next to her was Jack Lance, her client and the CEO of the insurance company, with $25 million on the line. She was still smarting from her brilliant but botched scheme to nail Bruce Cable, but she was also rallying quickly with the hint that the manuscripts might be in play. She knew Cable was not on Camino Island, but did not know he was in France. The FBI knew he had flown to Nice, but had not followed him. They had not shared this information with Elaine. Thomas Kendrick and Richard Farley sat opposite Elaine and Lance. President Carlyle handed over the folder and said, "This was given to us yesterday in Paris. It's a sample from Gatsby, and we have verified its authenticity." Elaine opened the folder and took a look. Lance did too, and neither reacted. Kendrick told the story of meeting with Gaston Chappelle and laid out the terms of the deal. When he finished, Carlyle said, "Obviously, our priority is getting the manuscripts. Catching the crook would be nice, but right now that doesn't really matter." Elaine said, "So, we're not including the FBI?" Farley said, "Legally, we don't have to. There is nothing wrong with a private transaction, but we'd like your thoughts. You know them much better than we do." Elaine shoved the folder a few inches away and thought about her response. She spoke slowly, every word measured. "I talked to Lamar Bradshaw 2 days ago. The three men who stole the manuscripts are in custody, and one has cut a deal. The two accomplices have not been found, but the FBI has their names and the search is on. As far as the FBI is concerned, the crime has been solved. They will frown on such a private deal, but they will understand. Frankly, they'll be relieved if the manuscripts are returned." "You've done this before?" Carlyle asked. "Oh, yes, several times. The ransom is secretly paid. The goods are returned. Everybody is happy, especially the owner. And the crook, too, I suppose." Carlyle said, "I don't know. We have a great relationship with the FBI. They've been superb from the beginning. It just doesn't seem right to exclude them at this point." Elaine replied, "But they have no authority in France. They'll be forced to bring in the authorities over there and will lose control. A lot of people will get involved and it could get messy. One small mistake, something no one can predict beforehand, and the manuscripts are gone." Farley asked, "Assuming we get them back, how will the FBI react when it's over?" She smiled and said, "I know Lamar Bradshaw pretty well. If the manuscripts are safely tucked away in your library and the thieves are in prison, he'll be a happy boy. He'll keep the investigation open for a few months, and maybe the crook will make a mistake. But before long, he and I will have a drink in Washington and share a good laugh." Carlyle looked at Farley and Kendrick and finally said, "Okay, let's proceed without them. Now, the sticky question of the money. Mr. Lance?" The CEO cleared his throat and said, "Well, we're on the hook for $25 million, but that's for a complete loss. This is shaping up to be something far different." "Indeed it is," Carlyle said with a smile. "Assuming the crook has all five, the math is easy. Of the 20, how much might you be willing to kick in? Without hesitation, Lance said, "We'll do half, no more." Half was more than Carlyle was hoping for, and as an academic, he felt somewhat off balance trying to negotiate with a hardened CEO of an insurance company. He looked at Farley and said, "Arrange the other half." On the other side of Rue Saint-Sulpice, and less than 40 feet from the front door of Librairie Gaston Chapelle, was the Hotel Proust, an old, quaint, four-story place with typically cramped rooms and a single elevator, barely large enough for one adult and his or her luggage. Bruce used a fake Canadian passport and paid cash for a room on the third floor. In the window, he set up a small camera aimed at the front of Gaston's shop. He watched the live footage on his iPhone in his room at the Hotel Delacroix, around the corner on Rue de Seine. Noelle, in her room at Hotel Bonaparte, watched it too. On her bed were the five manuscripts, each in a different type of bag. At 11 a.m., she left with a shopping bag and went to the lobby, where she asked the front desk to keep the maids away from her room because her husband was sleeping. She left the hotel, crossed the street, and stopped at the window of a dress boutique. Bruce walked by and, without stopping, took the bag. She returned to her hotel room to protect the remaining manuscripts and also to watch what happened at Gaston's shop. Strolling by the fountain in front of the classical church, St. Sulpice, and trying hard to blend in with the other tourists, Bruce burned some clock as he fortified himself for what was ahead. The next few hours would change his life dramatically. If he was walking into a trap, he would be hauled home in chains and sent away for years. But if he pulled it off, he would be a rich man, and only Noelle would know it. He walked a few blocks, always circling back and covering his trail. Finally, it was time to begin the delivery. He entered the bookstore and found Gaston poring over an old atlas, pretending to be busy but watching the street. There were no customers. His clerk had been given the day off. They stepped into his cluttered office in the rear, and Bruce removed a cedar box. He opened it, then opened the archival box inside, and said, "The first one, this side of paradise." Gaston gingerly touched the top leaf and said in English, "Looks fine to me." Bruce left him there. He opened and closed the front door, glanced up and down the narrow street, and walked away as nonchalantly as possible. Noelle watched the video from the camera in the Hotel Proust and saw nothing unusual. Using a prepaid cell phone, Gaston called a number at the Credit Suisse Bank in Geneva and informed his contact that the first delivery had been completed. As instructed by Bruce, the ransom war chest was sitting in a Zurich bank, waiting. As instructed, the first installment was wired to a numbered account at AGL Bank in Zurich, and upon its arrival, it was wired to another numbered account in a bank in Luxembourg. Sitting in front of a laptop in his hotel room, Bruce received an email confirming the two wires. A black Mercedes stopped in front of Gaston's, and Thomas Kendrick got out. He was in and out in less than a minute and left with the manuscript. He went straight to his office, where Dr. Jeffrey Brown was waiting, along with another Princeton librarian. They opened the boxes and marveled at the prize. Patience was required, but the waiting was torturous. Bruce changed clothes and went for a long walk. At a sidewalk cafe on the Rue des Écoles in the Latin Quarter, he managed to choke down a salad. Two tables away, Noel sat down for a coffee. They ignored each other until he left, with a backpack she had placed in a chair. A few minutes after one, he entered Gaston's again and was surprised to see him chatting with a customer. Bruce eased to the rear and placed the backpack on his office desk. When Gaston managed to slip away, they opened the second cedar box and looked at Fitzgerald's scrawl. Bruce said, "The Beautiful and Damned," published in 1922, and perhaps his weakest effort. "Looks fine to me," Gaston said. "Make the call," Bruce said, and left. 15 minutes later, the wire transfers were confirmed. Not long after that, the same black Mercedes stopped in the same place, and Thomas Kendrick fetched number 2 from Gaston. Gatsby was the next in order of publication, but Bruce was saving it for last. His fortune was coming together nicely, but he still worried about the final delivery. He found Noel sitting in the shade of an elm tree in Luxembourg Gardens. Beside her was a brown paper bag with the name of a bakery on it. For good measure, the end of a baguette protruded out of the top. He broke it off and chomped away as he headed for Gaston's. At 2:30, he entered the bookstore, handed over the bag and what was left of the baguette, along with "Tender is the Night" to his friend, and hustled away. To mix things up, the third wire went to a Deutsche Bank branch in Zurich, then to a numbered account in a London bank. When the two were confirmed, his fortune went from 7 figures to 8. Kendrick appeared again to pick up number 3. Back in his office, Dr. Jeffrey Brown was giddy as the collection grew. The fourth manuscript, that of The Last Tycoon, was hidden in a Nike gym bag Noel carried into a Polish bookstore on Boulevard Saint Germain. While she browsed, Bruce carried it away and walked 4 minutes to Library Chapelle. The Swiss banks would close at 5. At a few minutes before 4, Gaston called Thomas Kendrick and passed along some somber news. For Gatsby, his acquaintance wished to be paid in advance. Kendrick kept his cool, but argued that this was not acceptable. They had an agreement, and so far both sides had behaved. "True," Monsieur Chapelle said politely, "but the danger, as my contact sees it, is that he makes the final delivery and those on your end decide to forego the last installment. And what if we wire the final payment and he decides to keep the manuscript?" Kendrick replied. "I suppose that's a risk you'll have to take," Gaston said. "He is rather adamant." Kendrick took a deep breath and looked at the horror-stricken face of Dr. Brown. "I'll call you back in 15 minutes," he said to Gaston. Dr. Brown was already on the phone to Princeton, where President Carlyle had not left his desk for the past 5 hours. There was really nothing to discuss. Princeton wanted Gatsby far worse than the crook needed another $4 million. They would take their chances. Kendrick called Chapelle and passed along the news. When the final wire transfer was confirmed at 4:45, Chapelle called Kendrick back and informed him that he was holding the Gatsby manuscript in the rear seat of a taxi waiting outside his office building on Avenue Montaigne. Kendrick bolted from his office with Dr. Brown and his colleague giving chase. They sprinted down the wide stairway, rushed past the startled receptionist and out the front door just as Gaston was emerging from the taxi. He handed over a thick briefcase and said that Gatsby was all there with the exception of page 1 of chapter 3. Leaning against a tree not 50 yards away, Bruce Cable watched the exchange and enjoyed a good laugh. Epilogue. 8 inches of overnight snow had blanketed the campus, and by mid-morning, crews were hustling with plows and shovels to clear the walkways and doorsteps so that classes could go on. Students in heavy boots and coats wasted little time between classes. The temperature was in the teens, and the wind was biting. According to the schedule he'd found online, she should be in a classroom in Quigley Hall, teaching a class in creative writing. He found the building, found the room, and managed to hide and stay warm in a second-floor lobby until 10:45. He slipped back into the winter and loitered on a sidewalk beside the building, pretending to chat on his cell phone to avoid any suspicion. It was too cold for anyone to notice or care. Bundled as he was, he could have been just another student. She came out the front door and headed away from him in a crowd, one that swelled as other buildings emptied with the change of classes. He followed at a distance and noticed she was accompanied by a young man, one with a backpack. They turned here and there and appeared to be headed for the Strip, a row of shops and cafes and bars just off the campus of Southern Illinois University. They crossed a street, and as they did, her companion took her elbow as if to help. As they walked on, even faster, he let it go. They ducked into a coffee house, and Bruce stepped into the bar next door. He stuffed his gloves in a coat pocket and ordered black coffee. He waited 15 minutes, time enough to knock off the chill, then went to the coffee house. Mercer and her friend were huddled over a small table, coats and scarves draped over their chairs, fancy espresso drinks in front of them, deep in conversation. Bruce was beside the table before she saw him. "Hello, Mercer," he said, ignoring her friend. She was startled, even stunned, and seemed to gasp. Bruce turned to her friend and said, "I'm sorry, but I need a few minutes with her. I've come a long way." "What the hell?" the guy said, ready for a row. She touched his hand and said, "It's okay. Just give us a few minutes." He slowly got to his feet, took his coffee, and as he left them, he brushed by Bruce, who let it go. Bruce took the guy's chair and smiled at Mercer. "Cute guy. One of your students?" She collected herself and said, "Seriously? Is that really any of your business?" "Not at all. You look great, Mercer, minus the tan. It's February in the Midwest, a long way from the beach. What do you want?" "I'm doing fine, thanks for asking, and how are you?" "Great, how'd you find me?" "You're not exactly hiding. Mort Gasper had lunch with your agent, who told the sad story of Wally Stark dropping dead the day after Christmas. They needed a pinch hitter this spring for a writer in residence, and here you are. You like this place?" "It's okay. It's cold and the wind blows a lot." She took a sip of coffee. Neither looked away. "So how's the novel coming along?" he asked, smiling. "Good. Half finished and writing every day." "Zelda and Ernest?" She smiled and seemed amused. "No, that was a stupid idea." "Quite stupid, but you seem to like it, as I recall. So what's the story?" Mercer took a deep breath and glanced around the room. She smiled at him and said, "It's about Tessa, her life on the beach, and her granddaughter, and her romance with a younger man, all nice and fictionalized. Porter? Someone very similar to him. I like it. Have they seen it in New York? My agent has read the first half and is quite enthusiastic. I think it's going to work. I can't really believe this, Bruce, but it's nice to see you, now that the shock is wearing off. And it's nice to see you as well, Mercer. I wasn't sure it would ever happen. Why is it happening now? Unfinished business. She took a sip and wiped her lips with a napkin. Tell me, Bruce, when did you first suspect me? He looked at her coffee, some variety of a latte with too much foam and what appeared to be caramel squirted on top. May I? He asked as he reached for it. She said nothing as he took a sip. He said, the moment you arrived. At that time, I was on high alert and watching every new face, and with good reason. You had the perfect cover, the perfect story, and I thought it might be true. I also thought it might be a brilliant plan hatched by someone. Whose idea was it, Mercer? I'd rather not say. Fair enough. The closer we got, the more suspicious I became. And at the time, my gut was telling me that the bad guys were closing in. Too many strange faces in the store. Too many fake tourists poking around. You confirmed my fears, so I made the move. A clean getaway, huh? Yes, I got lucky. Congratulations. You're a great lover, Mercer, but a lousy spy. I'll take both as a compliment. She took another sip and handed him the cup. When he gave it back, she asked, so what's the unfinished business? To ask why you did it. You tried to put me away for a long time. Isn't that a risk all crooks take when they decide to deal in stolen goods? You're calling me a crook? Of course. Well, I think you're a sneaky little bitch. She laughed and said, okay, we're even. Any more names to call me? He laughed too and said, no, not at the moment. She said, oh, I can think of a lot of things to call you, Bruce, but the good outnumber the bad. Thanks, I guess. So back to the question, why did you do it? She took a deep breath and looked around again. Her friend was sitting in a corner, checking his phone. Money. I was broke, in debt, vulnerable. A lot of excuses, really. It's something I'll always regret, Bruce. I'm sorry. He smiled and said, that's why I'm here. That's what I wanted. An apology? Yes, and I accept it. No hard feelings. You're awfully magnanimous. I can afford to be, he said, and both chuckled. Why did you do it, Bruce? I mean, looking back, it was worth it, but at the time it was incredibly risky. It wasn't planned, believe me. I've bought and sold a few rare books on the black market. I guess those days are over now. But at the time I was just minding my own business when I got a call. One thing led to another, and the plot gained momentum. I saw an opportunity, decided to seize it, and in short order I had possession. But I was in the dark, and I had no idea how close the bad guys were until you came along. Once I realized I had a spy in the house, I had to make a move. You made it happen, Mercer. Are you trying to thank me? Yes, you have my sincerest gratitude. Don't mention it. As we know, I'm a lousy spy. Both were enjoying the conversation as they took another sip. She said, I gotta tell you, Bruce, when I read that the manuscripts were back at Princeton, I had a good laugh. I felt sort of foolish to get played like that, but I also said, go, Bruce. It was quite the adventure, but I'm one and done. I doubt that. I swear. Look, Mercer, I want you to come back to the island. The place means a lot to you. The cottage, the beach, the friends, the bookstore, Noel, and me. The door is always open. If you say so. How's Andy? I think about him all the time. Sober and fiercely so. He attends AA twice a week and is writing like a madman. That's wonderful news. Myra and I were talking about you last week. There were questions about your abrupt departure, but no one has a clue. You belong there, and I want you to feel free to come see us. Finish your novel, and we'll throw a huge party. That's very gracious, Bruce, but with you, I'll always be suspicious. I might go back, but no more fooling around. He squeezed her hand, stood, and said, "We'll see." He kissed her on the top of her head and said, "Goodbye for now." She watched him ease between the tables and leave the coffee house. This concludes the reading of Camino Island by John Grisham. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.